It's a rare day that the world's focus does not fall on the Middle East, at least for a little while. Iraq, Libya, and Syria are frequent generators of headlines, with combat and bombings and internal strife. And the United States is never far out of the picture. Our focus on the Middle East as a country is the focus of a new book from Andrew J. Basevich called America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Andrew Basevich is a retired professor of history at Boston University. Before that, he served more than two decades in the U.S. Army as a commissioned officer, retiring as a colonel. Andrew is the author of seven other books, including Washington Rules, for which he joined us on The Exchange in 2010. He also visited Southern Oregon University and The Exchange in 2012. Andrew Basevich, good to have you back on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, thanks very much.
Four decades of war, you say, and in your quote, "We have not won it, we are not winning it. Simply trying harder is unlikely to produce a different outcome." Draw us a map first. What do we include in the Middle East in this discussion?
Well, I guess I'd begin drawing the map by explaining where I begin my story. And I begin my story in 1980, and I choose that date because that's when President Jimmy Carter promulgated what came to be known as the Carter Doctrine. A statement that from that point forward, the United States considered the Persian Gulf a place that was worth fighting for. That statement began the process of militarizing U.S. policy, not simply in the Persian Gulf, but more broadly in large parts of the Islamic world, not what Carter foresaw or even intended. But the fact is that beginning in 1980 and running down to the present, we have undertaken a wide variety of military campaigns, large, small, brief, protracted, all in an effort to shape the greater Middle East. The shape is the term that they like in the Pentagon. But bringing us to where we are today, where that shaping, the success of that shaping effort is nowhere in sight. So I'm trying to get inviting readers to take on this long story in hopes that that will enable readers then to reach a judgment about whether or not this military enterprise makes sense.
When you raised the issue, Jimmy Carter, and it was in the State of the Union address in January of 1980, what came to be called the Carter Doctrine, you refer to this in the book as capitulation. To what, from what?
Well, capitulation in this sense, 6 months earlier, in the summer of 79, President Carter had gone on TV and made a very famous speech, inaccurately characterized as his malaise speech.
He never used the word.
No. The context of that speech was the second oil shock of the 1970s, a direct result of the Iranian Revolution. That oil shock had reminded Americans that our way of life was increasingly dependent upon access to foreign oil. Carter said, "My fellow Americans, we're going down the wrong path. We have come to a false understanding of freedom, too much focused on consumption. We need to return to a traditional set of values and he said, addressing our dependence on oil is the way actually to bring about this moral renewal." That was his pitch. It was not well received. Americans didn't want to sacrifice. They wanted more, not less. And in January of 1980, the capitulation, I think, is that Carter basically said, "Okay, I get the message." And rather than changing the way we live, we're going to begin the process of ensuring that we have access to the Persian Gulf oil that, at least at that point, seemed to be critical to the American way of life.
The response to that speech, which again did not include the term malaise, but came to be used widely afterward, is really interesting to look at because you give him some points for the content there. Say it's maybe not in delivery, but that in content it's one of the better speeches any president's given, certainly in the 20th century. But the fact, and it was received well initially, and then the tide seemed to turn.
Yes, very briefly. There was an appeal inherent in the speech, and I think what happened is Americans responded positively, and then they began to contemplate the implications of what the president was saying, and they didn't like those implications. They were no more Americans of that generation, were no more prone than Americans of the present generation to sacrifice. And so they weren't buying what Pastor Carter was selling. Nonetheless, when we take into account all the subsequent events that have occurred and the way we have been drawn into what really does appear to be a state of virtual perpetual war, that speech by Carter in the summer of 79 reminds us that there was an alternative path. There was a road that we might have taken that we chose not to take, and we are living with the consequences of that decision. And I think the key point here is Carter simply presented the alternative, but in what was in effect an informal plebiscite, we the people chose to disregard his call for change and to plow ahead.
So essentially we said, yeah, we'll take the cheap gas and whatever that entails.
Yes. I mean, granted, in saying we'll take the cheap gas, nobody then was envisioning the downstream implications, which have included all of these wars, which included the 9/11 attacks, which included the vast outlays, now into the trillions of dollars of money spent trying to bring order, restore order to parts of the Islamic world where we are militarily engaged. So there's a great tragedy here of a nation acting blindly, in part because of our short-sightedness, but blindly also because we overestimated the efficacy of our military power.
Well, it's a big, rich vein of subject and a big book, and we only have an hour to talk about it. Andrew Bacevich, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is America's War for the Greater Middle East. We'll come back and talk more with him and take your phone calls and emails. I do want to remind you, it is day one of Spring Fund Drive here on JPR. We'd love to get your pledge of support. 888-552-6191 or pledge online at ijpr.org. Back on the Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Andrew J. Bacevich, retired Army colonel and historian, and the author of a number of books looking at our role in foreign policy in the world, particularly our military policy. His latest book is called America's War for the Greater Middle East, a military history. You can join us on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Is it really fair, though, Andrew, to call our entire experience in the Middle East from about 1980 on a single war?
Well, I hope it's fair, because that's the premise of my book. But the point here is that the tendency has been, and the tendency is very much even today in the ongoing presidential campaign, to treat each one of these military campaigns, military operations, as something that kind of stands alone. And I would argue strongly that taking that perspective deprives us of a full understanding of the predicament that we're in. I mean, if we talk about the present moment, people are, to the extent that anybody is paying attention to what we're doing in the Middle East, the preoccupation is with ISIS. In the presidential campaign, Secretary Clinton, Senator Cruz, Mr. Trump, all basically argue, elect me president, and I will guarantee that we will defeat and destroy ISIS. None of them, however, shows any awareness of the factors that brought ISIS into existence in the first place, despite the fact that among those factors is previous misguided U.S. military action. So there is a great need for historical context that enables us to see beyond simply what's happening today and what happened, 24 hours ago.
You know, you note in the book that military planning all through this period, at least through the early period, and we're talking at this point the 1980s, military planning really did not take note of religion. It seems like it took a decade, maybe two and a half, for us to catch up.
Yeah, I mean, this I think is a must stand as a criticism of the military itself. In the early stages of the war for the greater Middle East, as you said, during the 1980s, really when the Pentagon, the military more broadly, was gearing up for intervention, the planners tended to see the problem at hand as one of time and distance. In other words, their concern was, how do we move thousands of troops, hundreds of thousands of tons worth of equipment, ammunition, where do we base them, how can we have overflight rights to move people and equipment? So they approached it as kind of a mechanical problem and tended to be oblivious to historical, cultural, ideological, and religious issues, which, again, with the benefit of hindsight in 2016, we would, I think, put at the very center of this problem that we're dealing with. But it took a very painful process of education for the U.S. military to come to this awareness of these other dimensions of the region.
You were just talking about presidential politics. I believe our question, our first caller question, is about that very subject. Here's Skeeter in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Andrew Basevich, the author of America's War for the Greater Middle East.
Hiya. Hi. You so much. I'm wondering if you have any comments at all about the so-called October surprise scenario. I know it's controversial. And also, if you were president, or at least a big advisor, and I sure wish you were, to the Prez, how would you address this whole situation in the so-called Middle East? It seems like the United States is very inept and keeps on creating Frankenstein monsters that keep getting out of the lab. Anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you, Skeeter.
Let me focus on the second question, if I could, the what would you do question. And I'll try to make several points without being too long-winded about it. The first thing is, I think we need to be realistic in appraising the threat. If at the moment the concern is ISIS, it's understandable at the moment that the concern is ISIS. ISIS really doesn't constitute an existential threat or even a significant threat to the United States of America. And the way to protect ourselves from an entity like ISIS is really to self-protect, to ensure that our domestic security agencies are well-resourced and effectively led. We're talking here about the Coast Guard, the TSA, Border Security, FBI, making sure that those entities have what they need to minimize, because you cannot totally eliminate the possibility of a terrorist attack. And then beyond that, I think, is to recognize that ISIS does pose an existential threat to some people, specifically to the nations in that region, to Iran, to Iraq, to Saudi Arabia, to Turkey. And the diplomatic task, I think, is for the United States to get those nations who have a transcendent interest in collaborating against ISIS to get them to do that. And that's not easy because those nations differ from one another in a variety of ways, deep-seated differences. Nonetheless, I would argue strongly that were those countries to set aside their differences for the moment and collaborate against ISIS, they could deal with ISIS far more effectively than we can. Why do I say that? Because over the past 30-some years, U.S. military intervention in the region in various ways, in various places, has almost invariably either failed or produced consequences other than those that we expected when we launched the military enterprise.
So you said that ISIS is not an existential threat, not even a significant threat to the United States. Let's shift an ocean away, though. I mean, is it a more significant threat to Europe then?
Sure, it is. And Europe, obviously, I mean, the aftermath of this most recent attack in Belgium, I think, has revealed to all faced with this threat of militants. They need to get their act together, and yes, to the extent that we can assist them, we should help them get their act together, whether by sharing intelligence or other technological means. But there's a habit of mind stemming from the end of World War II that somehow posits that the United States of America should be responsible for the security of the Europeans. It made sense to have that state of mind back in 1946 or 1947 because Europe had been flattened by World War II. Their economies were weak. Politically, they had lost confidence in themselves. They were threatened by the Soviet Union. It was appropriate in the late 1940s for us to assume responsibility for European security. That was then. This is now. They are mature democracies that enjoy very considerable prosperity, and they should take a larger role in managing their own problems.
I've seen it said that they're still living in a pre-9/11 world in Europe. Is that a fair assessment, you think?
Well, I think that goes too far. I mean, and this is not an easy issue. The process of unification of Europe, really a project that began at the end of World War II, and has now moved to the point where we have this thing called the European Union. But the European Union is not an effective union. It has not produced the sort of unity of effort that one would expect of a nation state. So the European Union is somewhere in between being a European equivalent of the United States of America on the one hand, and being a collection of sovereign states on the other hand. It would seem to me that the imperative is for Europe to either forge genuine unity, which will require deeper integration within the EU, or it should be incumbent upon them to acknowledge that the EU is a failure and to revert to a Europe that consists of sovereign states, each of which would be responsible for its own security. But the current middle ground, it seems to me, does not serve their interests and renders them vulnerable to entities like ISIS.
Andrew J. Basevich is retired military army colonel and retired historian. Well, he's not a retired. He's still a historian, but a retired history professor at Boston University and the author of America's War for the Greater Middle East. You can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The first incident listed in the book is the failed attempt to free the American hostages in Tehran, Iran, in 1980. We learned a few things from that, I'm thinking. For example, though, I want to specifically go to, like, the mission to kill Osama bin Laden, where there was a helicopter failure, for example. Did we learn enough from what happened at Desert One to make better missions, better prepared?
Well, yes missions? And no. I mean, the Desert One operation, as some people will remember, was enormously complex and difficult. And failed largely as a consequence of equipment failures that basically prevented the mission even from reaching the objective. And sadly, Americans were killed as a result of those equipment failures. So, yes, the Pentagon learned a lot in the sense that the humiliation of Desert One led to a very pronounced effort to improve the quality and capability of U.S. Special Operations Forces, so that what we have today in that regard compared to what existed in 1980, really, it bears no comparison. The size of the Special Operations community, the capabilities that it has, they are astonishing and remarkable. On the other hand, I would argue we didn't learn anything. Didn't learn anything in the sense that the U.S. political authorities and military leaders came out of Desert Storm still persuaded that somehow or other the adroit application of military power could fix things. And we have then tried to fix things, whether by invading countries and occupying them or by bombing countries to punish them, by sending in peacekeepers, humanitarian intervention, counterinsurgency, counterterrorism, all with an expectation that somehow or other conditions in the region are going to improve. And sadly, you know, here we are in 2016, they haven't improved. Indeed, there is greater disorder and dysfunction across much of the Islamic world today than there was back in 1980 when we first began to introduce U.S. forces into the region. Now, that disorder and that dysfunction is not exclusively the result of what things the United States has done, but certainly our efforts have not made things better.
The shadow of Vietnam hangs heavy over all of this, and I know your own military experiences from the Vietnam era. It seems like the idea then was that we were either going to do it big or not do it at all, and yet we seem to end up in this middle zone again, or have ended up in this middle zone again, where we don't want to commit all sorts of military force to something, but also don't want to commit nothing at the same time.
I think you are describing that quite accurately. Certainly, within the officer corps in the first couple of decades after Vietnam, Never Again Vietnam was the unspoken priority. And when, for example, we saw Operation Desert Storm, the Gulf War of 1990-1991, the approach that the George Herbert Walker Bush administration took to that war attempted to apply what were perceived to be the lessons of Vietnam. And you stated it correctly. Go in big, go in to win, avoid getting bogged down. But Desert Storm produced is a good example of a campaign that produced unintended consequences. And one of the consequences was that it persuaded political authorities, more than the military itself, persuaded political authorities that the United States possessed such overwhelming U.S. military supremacy that it should begin to use that, put that military to work more aggressively. And this really came home after 9/11, when the George W. Bush administration and key people like Vice President Cheney, Secretary Rumsfeld, Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz set out to change the region, saw Iraq as an inviting target to begin a project of transformation, regional transformation, but badly overstated our military capabilities and therefore gave rise to what turned out to be an epic catastrophe and landed us in a Vietnam-like quagmire.
Let's take some calls. We have Jeff in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Andrew Basevich, the author of America's War for the Greater Middle East. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. I'm kind of wondering about how much just a general American jingoism has to do with our involvement in various wars. I've noticed over the years that whenever we get involved in a war, especially in the early days of it, I see more cars with American flags waving on them. I see some places like car lots will put out hundreds of American flags. There's just all this, and that's kind of a, it could be called patriotism, but I think it's more what's been called jingoism, and I think that's very prevalent in this country. Also, it seems like war is good for business. Whenever, you know, there's a war, it seems like there's these companies that they're contractors, and they make hundreds of millions, if not billions and billions of dollars off of the wars. And I just wonder how much those things play into it. It seems like this country always wants to be in a war except for maybe like after Vietnam.
Okay, yeah. So jingoism and jingoism and the military-industrial complex. Thanks for that, Jeff. Appreciate it, Andrew. Thoughts?
Let me comment on the. I mean, yes, there's a military-industrial complex. There's no question about it. But let me focus on the first point, which I think is a very good point. I mean, the caller is referring it to it as jingoism. I think I'd refer to it more as kind of a thin patriotism. It is true that when the United States initiates some new military campaign, there is a pretty broad-based impulse, I think, to believe that our obligation as citizens is to support the troops. And so, yes, we raise flags and to try to bear witness to the fact that we are supporting the troops. The problem, it seems to me, is that those testimonials of support are symbolic, thin, and lacking in substance. And I would argue that one of the problems with our war for the greater Middle East, the fact that it has gone on and on, despite being counterproductive, is that we haven't, as citizens, we haven't been serious about what it really means to support the troops. And I would argue that one of the things it ought to mean is that because we care about the troops, that we are going to insist that they will only be sent to war when it is absolutely necessary, that we will insist that there be accountability when wars go awry, and sadly, that's not been the case.
Andrew Bacevich, our guest on The Exchange. His book is America's War for the Greater Middle East. We'll come back and talk more with him and take more phone calls and emails. Don't forget, day one of Spring Fund Drive. We can wrap this up sooner if we can get a big pile right at the beginning. So your pledges of support, welcome at 888-552-6191 and online at ijpr.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the retired Army Colonel and historian Andrew Bacevich. He's written a bunch of books about America's adventures around the world. The latest is called America's War for the Greater Middle East, a military history. You can join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email here from Joe in Talent who writes, "We have a Republican Party that is staggeringly ignorant of the Middle East, its history, culture, ethics, and religion, and it's going to get a lot of us killed. Motivated by fear and profit, we continue to make policy that completely disregards the wants and needs of over a billion people. Our colonial roots have conditioned us to believe what is ours, and what's theirs is ours as well by manifest destiny. If we had an imperial nation occupy us, take our resources, our land, and kill us when we resisted, we would do the same thing that's happening over there. Oh, wait, we did that back in the 1700s. That from Joe in Talent. Is it who we are as a people that makes us do what we do in the Middle East, largely? I mean, I guess that's a dumb question, but...
No, it's not a dumb question. I mean, I think that really is one of the core... Yes, it's who we are that causes us to do what we do, not simply in the Middle East, but in the world more broadly. And who we are a people who take it for granted that we should occupy a privileged position in the international order. We take it for granted that we should enjoy more than our fair share of security, of abundance, of freedom. And indeed, we have enjoyed more than our fair share for quite a long time, and that's why that expectation has come to be so deeply rooted. That said, I mean, if I caught the gist of the first part of the email, seemed to suggest that it's the ignorance of the Republicans that somehow explains where we've gotten to be. The account I offer in my book would suggest that there's been plenty of ignorance in both parties. The war for the greater Middle East, this war that we have been fighting for 3.5 decades, is a bipartisan project, and it has been endorsed by both parties, led by presidents of both parties, and neither party has a lock hold on ignorance or on wisdom in that regard.
Another call here from John in Veneta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning.
Hi.
This is very interesting. Thank you, Jeff. And thank you to the guest. Nobody likes a bully. And ever since, not long after World War II, this country, our country, has been sticking its nose in other people's business and bullying people and running all over the planet. And, you know, kind of slacked it over there for a couple decades, but it's worked in. And it's wrong. And I think what we could do, I want to see our defense abilities absolutely without question. And I'm not the type of guy that wants to bully or force somebody. But if somebody comes and does something and it's really threatening, I want them ground into the dirt. And you know what? If we break it, they get to fix it. And the last thing I want to say is every single penny that goes into taxes needs to be accounted for and open and for view online or in the newspaper regularly. Like every day even. And the people that are managing it, there's going to be a name connected to the increments of money. And if something funky happens, they get to go to prison. And like in driving zones where, fines double,
uh-huh.
How about quadruple the sentencing? And make people that are supposed to be responsible and taking care of what's going on, they are hired by us, they're employees, hired by us, commissioned to manage our resources and what's going on. And they have been absolute monsters as a whole.
All right. Thanks for that, John. Appreciate it. Thoughts, Andrew?
Well, I'm not going to stick up for the managerial abilities of those who run the government, because there certainly has been a heck of a lot of money wasted. But two, what I understood to be his point he was making in the first part of his call, the world is a complicated place. To my mind, this notion of global leadership, which seems to imply that the United States needs to have its finger in every pie, is just as flawed as the notion that we should simply look after ourselves and let the rest of the world go hang. I think there's a middle course, and the middle course really is one that's informed not so much by ideology or by vast historical claims. It's one that's informed by pragmatism, what works and what doesn't work. There have been instances, the U.S. involvement in Europe after World War II and in East Asia after World War II, where U.S. engagement and leadership helped to produce positive outcomes. I think there should be no debate on that score. But with regard to our military involvement in the Islamic world, which, again, to emphasize the point, this is not a recent development. We've been at it for decades now. Those efforts have not produced a positive outcome. They have cost us dearly. They have cost the people in the region dearly. We haven't made things better. And therefore, from simply a pragmatic point of view, there is an urgent need to think differently about the role that the United States should be playing in that region. The notion that somehow trying harder, dropping a few more bombs, sending a few more U.S. troops in, that's going to produce a different outcome simply cannot be sustained by the reality of the past three-plus decades.
So let's talk about one of the people who seems to think that way. You mentioned the name Paul Wolfowitz a little earlier, and he does come up surprisingly early in the book, around the time of Jimmy Carter's speech about the Carter Doctrine. What was the project that you mentioned that Wolfowitz was pushing even then?
Well, this was, he was the principal author of a document that early on identified Saddam Hussein as, in his judgment, the principal boogeyman of the region, and urged that the United States should begin to think seriously about making the Middle East a military priority. Up to that point, defending Europe and defending East Asia had been the two Pentagon priorities, and Wolfowitz played an important role, not necessarily a decisive role, and an important role in beginning to bureaucracy to refocus on some attention on the greater Middle East. His expectation was that if we could stop Saddam Hussein, eliminate Saddam Hussein, that all would be well. And, of course, we put that theory to the test in 2003, and the results were not those that he and other architects of the Iraq War expected.
The idea of American influence across the Middle East, though, seems like in another time with less careful politicians would have been used, the name used would have been empire. This is essentially what they're talking about, isn't it?
Yes. And I personally have no problem with using that term. I think we have been engaged in an imperial project. A lot of Americans balk at using terms like empire and imperialism to explain American behavior. I think that those terms come much closer are quite useful. So, yeah, we've been engaged in an imperial enterprise. We may have disguised it from ourselves by our use of language, and it hasn't worked. Again, the approach should be one of pragmatism. If indeed efforts by the United States to dominate large parts of the Islamic world had produced order, had advanced the well-being of our country and of the well-being of the people who live there, then one might say, well, good. Then it's been worth the effort. But the results, the actual results that we have achieved, have been almost entirely negative. And that's why I think it's so important for us to take on board the entire historical narrative. Don't just get focused on ISIS or the Syrian civil war, as urgent as they may seem today, but to put those phenomena in a broader historical context.
And memories are particularly long in that part of the world, it seems, aren't they?
I think that's a good point. Or maybe I'd flip it around and say that we Americans have a remarkably short memory,
right,
or maybe a remarkable aptitude for forgetting things that we don't care to remember.
Mm-hmm. Which brings up what will have to be our final question, which is how do casual observers then maintain a skeptical eye like you apply here? I mean, especially when interpretations of events seem to hinge entirely on who's in charge. For example, nobody ever used the term cut and run when Ronald Reagan pulled the Marines out of Beirut after the barracks bombing.
Well, which is, of course, what he did. He did cut and run. I don't know. You know, on that particular issue, we're kind of getting into the realm of the relative skill of politicians. And to take President Reagan as an example, he had a remarkable aptitude. I mean, it's a natural talent for spinning things in ways that enabled him to dodge responsibility. Whereas other politicians who are less adept, his predecessor, Jimmy Carter, would be an example, just got hammered for doing things that Reagan probably would have gotten away with.
Well, a lot to think about in this and all your books, as usual. Andrew Bacevich, our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange. This book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us today on the Exchange.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
All right, take care.